facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A tremendous Thursday to you. Welcome to the show. I am so pumped about this episode. We've got a very, very special guest, Steve Weidenkopf, a great, great author on church history and professor, is going to be joining us live on the program in just a few moments. You're going to want to call in with your burning questions about church history, whether it be the Crusades, the Galileo Affair, modern church history, ancient, doesn't matter. Steve is a jack of all trades and a jack of all ages, or Steve of all ages, I guess you could say, when it comes to church history. So call this number right now, 1-888-914-9149. Once again, 1-888-914-9149 for your questions about church history for Steve Weidenkopf. Or you could tweet at me, and some people have done so already. Tweet your question to at Cale Clark. That's my Twitter handle, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E, at Cale Clark. Or the show account, at Cale Clark Show. You could try that too. Or use good old sturdy email. It never fails. Cale@relevantradio.com is the email address. You can also send your question that way too. So we're not going to waste any time on this. We want to jump right in because we've got a lot to talk about and a lot of things to deal with when it comes to church history, which is pretty long, right? It's been over 2,000 years, and we're going to hop right in with our guest today, and that is Steve Weidenkopf. Now, Steve is a lecturer in church history at the Christendom College Graduate School of Theology in Alexandria, Virginia, and he is the author of many works on the history of the church, such as The Glory of the Crusades, The Real Story of Catholic History, Answering 20 Centuries of Anti-Catholic Myths, and also his latest work, Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church. He is also very well known as being a long-suffering fan of the New York Islanders hockey team, who are still alive in the Eastern Conference Finals of the Stanley Cup playoffs after a very dramatic double overtime victory over the Tampa Bay Lightning in Game 5, staving off elimination the other night. I wanted to make sure I got Steve on the show before tonight's Game 6, just in case things go sideways. He's still in a good mood right now. We want to welcome to the program Steve Weidenkopf. Steve, how are you?
I'm doing great, Cale. Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks for taking the time out, especially on a game night. And I know you're a big Cleveland Brown fan, too, so I'm sure you'll be switching channels back and forth between Thursday night football and hockey as well. But let me ask you this. We're not here to talk about hockey primarily, although we certainly will get some hockey talk in there at some point. But we want to talk about church history. And the first question I want to ask is, why is church history important to study in the first place?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Cale. It's an important question. It's a question that I try to address throughout, you know, my different books and the talks and presentations I give at parishes. And it's important for us as Catholics to know our history for a multitude of different reasons. You know, one is obviously to grow closer to Christ in studying our faith and studying the church. One is just to help us make sense of what's happening in the world today. It's really hard to really, you know, have a good sense of the occurrences in the modern day without having a sense of our history. But those reasons aside, really, there are two very important reasons that we as Catholics should study church history today. One is to grow in our identity as Catholics, right? I like to present and teach church history as being our family history. It's, you know, when we study church history, we're studying the actions of the men and women who have come before us in faith. They are our brothers and sisters in this great family of God that we have all been called to be members of. And by studying them, it's almost as if we're studying, you know, really our own spiritual genealogy, if you will. And we can't, you know, just like we would know our own family history and grow deeper in knowing who we are as members of the Clark family or members of the Weidenkopf family, so too we do that by studying church history. That's how we become more identified with the church and more identifiable as Catholics and with our Catholic faith. And then obviously the other reason to study church history is for apologetics, right? I mean, we know that our faith and the history of our faith is not always accurately presented in the media or in the modern day.
Really?
You know, it doesn't. Yeah, I know. It comes as a shock to most people. But you know, so when you see those things like the Crusades or the Inquisitions or other things that you mentioned, Galileo, these are all little hot-button topics that people always bring up. And if we don't know our history, then we are not able to defend the church when it's not presented correctly.
That makes sense. So what about in your own life, Steve? How has church history impacted your own faith journey with Christ?
Yeah, that's another good question. And for me, really, what's helped me over the years as I've delved into the history of the church and studying all the different things that went on is really, frankly, a greater devotion to the Holy Spirit. We believe in one God and three divine persons, and we spend a lot of focus, usually on God the Father, God the Son, and also God the Holy Spirit. But I think sometimes we tend to regulate the Holy Spirit to, the dove or tongues of fire at Pentecost and these kinds of things, all of which is true, but the Spirit is actually more right than that. I mean, God, the Holy Spirit, is animates the church. He guides the church and guards the church and has for 2,000 years. And when you see the actions that people have performed within the church and to the church, frankly, over 2,000 years, both the great and the not so great, the high times and the low times, what you come away with is this great sense of hope, this great sense of devotion to the Spirit, because without the Spirit, if the church was simply just a human institution, we wouldn't really be talking about 2,000 years, about a much lesser length of time. The church would have fallen upon itself, on its own dead weight, so to speak, if it was, but it's not. So it gives us happen in the church today, different crises or different scandals or whatnot. By knowing our church history, that also helps us to realize, have a more strategic or long-term focus, right? Not that we, ignore the problems of the modern day in the church, but knowing church history gives us a greater perspective to realize that the church has been through these things before. She's still here. She will continue to be here until Christ comes again.
That's very well said. We're with Steve Weidenkopf. He's our guest today on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. You want to call in right now because the phone lines are filling up. If you want to ask Steve your question about church history, and anything is fair game over the last 20 centuries, including this one, call this number, 1-888-914-9149. That's 1-888-914-9149. We're going to go to the phones right now. Thomas is calling from the same state where you teach, Steve. He's calling from Vienna, Virginia, and he has a question for you. Thomas, welcome to the show. You're on the Cale Clark Show with Steve Weidenkopf.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Cale. Thanks for taking the call. My question concerns the great schism in the church, where the Eastern Orthodox Church split from the Western Latin Church, as we note today. My question was what the reasoning was behind the Eastern Orthodox bishops and patriarchs as they chose to disregard Rome as the central seat of church authority and instead have their own central seats of authority.
Yeah, Thomas, thanks for that question. And, I'm sure the Easterners would maybe phrase that question slightly different in terms of their perspective of it. But, they would see themselves as almost Rome have gone astray at that point, and not necessarily them. But I mean, it's a complicated event in the life of the church. And as you mentioned, there was this great event in the summer of the year 1054 when you had some Roman legates who had actually papal legates who had come to Constantinople to meet with the patriarch because there had been some issues between East and West that had been building, frankly, for centuries leading up into the mid 11th century. And the immediate cause of what happened was there was a patriarch in Constantinople by the name of Michael Chilarius. And Chilarius was someone who was very adamant in his own authority, very adamant in being the patriarch. And what he did was he outlawed the celebration of Mass in Constantinople in accordance with the Latin Rite, in accordance with the Roman tradition. As you may know, or hopefully many listeners know, there's a difference in the way that the liturgy is celebrated between East and West churches, and that had been so for a period of time. Same thing happens at Mass, it's just a different way in which to participate in the liturgy. And so he outlawed the Roman Rite. He wanted everyone in Constantinople to celebrate Mass in accordance with the Eastern liturgy. And there was a very sizable Western population in Constantinople. It was an extremely large city, a lot of commerce with the West, especially with Venice and other Italian city-states. And so he outlawed this, and that caused a huge issue. And word of this got back to the Pope. The Pope send a delegation to Constantinople to address the issue, and he sent with, or the leader of this delegation was Cardinal Humbert. And Cardinal Humbert was a unique man in the West. He knew Greek, which was a rarity in the West at the time, but he also had what we would call today an anger management problem. He was very quick to be offended and very impatient. Not probably someone you want to send on a very, you know, delicate diplomatic mission, but he was the one who was chosen. He went to Constantinople. As soon as he got there, he engaged with Eastern writers there, especially monks. And one of the major use of leavened versus unleavened bread for the matter of the Eucharist and Mass. Right. So in the West, we used unleavened bread. In the East, they used leavened bread. There was a huge debate about what was the some issues.
Okay. Steve, I don't know if you can hear me, but we've got a little issue with your tie line here. We're going to call you back on your cell phone, okay? So please stand by, Steve, and please stand by, Thomas. We're answering your call about the split between what became the Orthodox churches of the East and the Catholic Church and all the historical circumstances in regards to that. So at the perils of live radio, folks, we've got a bit of an issue with Steve's connection, but we're going to get him back on the air very, very quickly. And in fact, he is already, I believe, on the line. So, Steve, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you guys
okay,
hear me?
That was very quick. So thanks for that. Apologies, folks. Why don't you continue on with your answer for Thomas about Orthodoxy?
Oh, sure. So I think where we hopefully everyone heard the situation, we've got Cardinal Humbert in Constantinople, and he's engaging in various letter-writing campaigns against Eastern monks who questioned the validity of the use of leavened versus unleavened bread in the liturgy. But Humbert quickly realizes that his whole embassy is going nowhere, and so he decides on his own authority to march into the Church of San Sofia, Hagia Sophia. And he slaps down on the altar in the summer of 1054 a bull of excommunication, where he excommunicated Patriarch Cellarius. Now, Humbert had no authority to do that. In fact, Pope St. Leo IX had died a few months before this actual event. And so once the Pope had died, then his papal legates had no authority whatsoever to represent him. There wasn't a Pope at that point. No one hasn't been elected yet. So he decided to do this on his own accord, and then soon after, Cellarius, upset with what Humbert did, decided to excommunicate Cellarius and not recognize the Pope and his authority in the Church. And so you kind of have this break in the recognition of Roman primacy in the East. So that's kind of the event that happens. Now, as you go through the centuries, there's some brief times of reconciliation between East and West, but sadly, as we know in the modern day, that separation continues despite the work of many modern popes, including John Paul II, to try to reconcile the two halves of the Church together.
Okay, hopefully that helps to answer your question, Thomas.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so much for your response.
Okay, appreciate that, Thomas. Thank you. Thomas calling from Vienna, Virginia. We're going to go back to the phones right now. We have John on the line from Philadelphia. And John, welcome to the Cale Clark Show. You are on the line with Steve Weidenkopf, church history professor.
Thank you very, very much. Excellent, program. At any rate, I understand that when the barbarians were burning the libraries around the world, some monks got some ships together down in Alexandria, Egypt, and they took the books out of the library, and then they sailed to the furthermost part of the world, which would have been Ireland. And ergo, we had all these monks over there keeping the books and then copying the books, and ultimately we took this information and reintroduced this information, the history, back to the Europeans setting up our universities, science, and all these other things that these books contain. And I when was that? And how many ships were they? And if you can fill in the blanks for us.
Okay, John, we accidentally lost Steve just for a moment on the cell phone. Can you very, very quickly, in about 10 seconds or less, please repeat your question? It's basically about how the Irish saved civilization, right?
Well, that's when we brought the reintroduced the information to Europe. But when did it happen that they took the books from Alexandria, and how many ships? When was it, and how many ships?
Okay, Steve, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I'm not exactly certain the story you're referring to in terms of the ships coming from Alexandria and whatnot. But I mean, if the question kind of centers around, you know, the preservation of Western civilization and the culture of the West through, you know, the writings of the copying of the monks and scriptoriums, I mean, that happens as we get to, basically, fundamentally, Europe changes, Christendom radically changes at the end of the 5th century when you have the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West, right? Central governing authority from Rome collapses in the West at the end of the 5th century, and things kind of devolve down to a local level. And so you have this lack of you know, institutional sharing of knowledge because of the governmental collapses that occurs over time. And so there are multiple tribes within Europe that have come into what is modern day Europe that are Germanic. You know, they're barbarians. They don't have necessarily, you know, an educational background. Obviously, definitely not in Roman, Greco-Roman culture. And so you have the spread of Saint Benedict and his monasteries through the fifth and into the 6th centuries and whatnot, where you have these monks in the scriptoriums copying manuscripts from Rome and from Greek authors and from the ancient world. And that's how the church continues to preserve Western civilization and the culture of the West.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, John, for your call. Calling from Philadelphia, John, listening to the program. And Steve, you know, here's another question that I get a lot, and you probably do too, from my non-Catholic friends. You know, one question that I get a lot is, throughout history, people want to say that the Catholic Church is responsible for more wars than any other organization or nation in the history of the world. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, that's a common refrain, right? A common myth, and I've heard that myself as well. And you know, what I would argue is that there was a study, and I'm trying to remember, it was done early in the 2000s, and it was basically, I think, a history of warfare. And the ones who put, I mentioned this in my, and I cited actually in my book, The Real Story of Catholic History, on this very, very question. But in that, in this study that these authors performed, they went back and looked at all wars, you know, through the history of humanity, right? As many as far back as we know, and looking at all the different records. And they found, and I'm kind of doing this from memory, so the percentage might not be exactly correct, but they found that I think it was 10% or less, really, of the wars that were caused in the world can be directly tied to some kind of religious conflict. And even they went further, that if you take out, frankly, the wars that were undertaken by Islam and in the conquest of Islam in the name of Islam, it actually lowers the percentage even more significantly to something like 3-5%. I mean, it's significant. And so they looked at, and the vast majority of why wars are started, it's not started by religion. It started because of some kind of political issue, obviously, or mostly economic, frankly, or some social issue. Has nothing to do with faith and religion as a whole. So religion is actually, especially the Christian faith, is a pacifying, frankly, you know, phenomenon in the history of the world, and not one that generates you know, violence. So you hear that refrain a lot, and a lot of people like to cite the Crusades for that. But when you look at the Crusades, you know, even if you extend the definition of them, you're looking at 500, 600 years worth of history, and they're not constant ongoing wars, and they're very central, they're very, you know, geographically focused campaigns, if you will. So if we look at the 20th century and the two world wars, I mean, how many millions of people died as a result of those wars? And neither one of those wars had anything to do with religion.
That's a very, very good point. And since you brought up the Crusades, Steve, I think it's good to jump in on that topic right now, because that is obviously a question that is on a lot of people's minds when it comes to church history. You mentioned the localized nature of the Crusades. What really touched off the Crusades? How did they all get started?
Yeah, the immediate cause is you have towards the end of the 11th century, you have a group of people known as the Seljuk Turks who come down off the Asian steppe. into what is modern-day Turkey, right, into Asia Minor, what was then called the Byzantine province of Anatolia. And they begin to attack the Byzantine Empire, and over time they basically conquer that entire province. They win a great victory at a battle known as the Battle of Manzikert in 1071. And so the Eastern Empire is under attack, really. And what happens at the end of the 11th century, you have representatives from the emperor, from the Byzantine Emperor. They go to the West. They go to the Pope, actually, and at the time it was Gregory the Seventh, and ask him to marshal some Western troops and send them to the east in order to help defend the Byzantine Empire against the incursion of the Seljuk Turks. St. Gregory the Seventh is involved in too many other internal issues in terms of the church and politics, with especially the King of the Germans, Henry the Fourth at the time. So he is not able to really do much with this request, but eventually it falls to his successor, Blessed Urban the Second. And in the year 1095, at the local Council of Clermont in France, Pope Urban II calls what comes to be known as the First Crusade, asking Western knights to leave their family and their property and to go to the east and help liberate the holy city of Jerusalem from the occupation of Muslim forces, and also doing indirectly helping the Byzantines defend their territory and their frontier from the Seljuk Turks. And there's an immediate response. I mean, he actually goes through France for the rest of the year there and preaching the crusade. He sends preachers throughout Christendom who also preach it. And there's an overwhelming response. It's estimated that 100,000 people took the cross to go on this armed campaign. Yeah, and he centered it as a spiritual, his discussion of it and his motivation that way in which he described it, I guess, was a pilgrimage, right? So the people who went on these expeditions, these crusades, they saw themselves as pilgrims. This was an armed pilgrimage. They were going to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, specifically in Jerusalem, to liberate it. And he attached, because it was a spiritual pilgrimage, or was a pilgrimage rather, he attached the indulgence to it. You received this special spiritual privilege for participating. And that was the prime motivator that moved people to join the crusade and to go on it. And so, and one witness or one explanation for that, data point for that, is of the 100,000 I mentioned who went, only about 60,000 of those on the First Crusade were actually warriors of some sort. So you had 40,000 people who were non-combatants who went on the crusade because of the spiritual indulgence that they could receive, and because of their desire to go to Jerusalem and to see it liberated and returned to Christian hands. And frankly, those non-combatants caused a bit of a problem for the warriors on crusade throughout these different campaigns.
We're with Steve Weidenkopf here, our guest on the Catholic show. Yeah, it is a Catholic show. It's the Cale Clark Show. I was so enthralled by your explanation of the crusades and Catholic Church history, which is what we're talking about here on the show today. I kind of got lost there and became a fan myself just listening. But thank you very much, Steve, for that answer. And we have many, many more questions that we're going to get to on this program right after the short break. You're going to want to call this number, 1-888-914-9149, to get your question on about church history with Steve Weidenkopf, who's our guest today on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Lots more modern history, ancient church history. We've got it all. The Middle Ages, the so-called Dark Ages. What about those? So many things we can talk about, and we'll tackle it all right after this break on the Cale Clark Show.
Day 10, Mother Most Chaste, pray for us. It's not that the church is hung up on sex or the church is prudish. It's simply that the church promotes and defends human dignity and recognizes that the human race is the pinnacle of God's visible creation. Human beings have been created for eternity to give glory to God. That's why the church guards and elevates human sexuality and protects it in the sacred bond of matrimony. Children have a right to know their mother and father. Children have a right to be born and raised in a family. And the human race is a blessing to planet Earth. That's why the virtue of chastity is necessary. It safeguards sex and places it within the stability of marriage. Sex is always safe when used as God has intended it, between a man and a woman, open to life and within marriage. In that context, it is holy. Mother Most Chaste, pray for the church and our nation.
Receive these free daily messages by signing up at relevantradio.com/novena.
My anxiety is what led me to start going to daily mass.
Relevant Radio contributor Gary Zimek.
Daily mass is a big reason why I'm able to feel peace, and it's a reason why I grow closer to the Lord. This is why I've listened to Relevant Radio for so many years. I don't just come on the air with you when I'm a guest, John. I listen. Relevant Radio has been a lifeline to me. When I'm struggling, when I am anxious, I get to hear the truth. I get to be lifted up.
Bringing Christ to the world through the media. Relevant Radio.
The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. That's getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Pollock with a blast of a drive. Everly has scored in double overtime. And there will be a game six on Thursday night.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, we wanted our guest, Steve Weidenkopf, who's here to talk about church history, and he's a huge New York Islander fan, to be really much, very much at home on this program, so we thought we'd give him some good vibes as he gets ready for Game 6 tonight. That was Islanders Broadcasting, talking about their big double overtime Game 5 win. It's interesting. There is, Steve, I think, a real connection between hockey, leadership, and church history. Let me try to draw this out. I know that this might sound convoluted, but a couple years ago, back in 2018, the superstar for the New York Islanders, John Tavares, decides to take his Toronto Maple Leafs bed sheets that he used to sleep in when he was a kid and come home to Toronto, leave the island. And a lot of Islanders fans were super, super upset about that, of course. Then what happens? Well, Lou Lamoriello leaves the Toronto Maple Leafs and goes to Long Island as the president, general manager. Obviously, he had a storied career with the New Jersey Devils, comes to the Leafs, eventually gets to the island. He hires the coach of the reigning Stanley Cup champions at the time, the Washington Capitals, Barry Trotz, maybe the best coach in the NHL. And all of a sudden, you've got a solid leadership team in Long Island. And look what happens. You know, the Islanders, maybe not as much talent on the ice, perhaps. Depends how you look at it. But here they are in the Eastern Conference Finals. How important is leadership when it comes to church history? Bad leadership, good leadership, how can it make a difference in how things play out in the history of the church?
Yeah, Cale, that's a very good question. And before I get to that, I do have to just say thanks so much for putting that broadcast there on as we came out of the break, because that did bring, you couldn't see it, but I had a huge smile on my face when I was listening to that. You guys put Kinger, the radio guy for the Islanders, up on your show, calling that fantastic Everly goal to send it to Game 6 here. So hopefully the boys play well tonight. But yeah, the leadership is, as you mentioned, is extremely important, right? Whether it's a hockey team or whether it's, a company or organization, or obviously when it comes to the church. I mean, you look through the years past and centuries past of church history, and you can see, there's, all kinds of examples of fantastic leaders, holy leaders, especially at the papacy, but even, saints as well. Frankly, one great leader that comes to mind, that to my mind immediately when I think of church history, that many people might not immediately think of, is St. Catherine of Siena. Mm-hmm. A beautiful, holy woman who lived in the 14th century, who led not only in her own personal life in terms of holiness and how she lived out her faith, but even more importantly, the leadership she exercised for the church as a whole. This is a time when the church, when the papacy, rather, was in Avignon. The popes were living in France. They weren't even in Rome. Still the Bishop of Rome, but absent from the diocese, and had been for nearly 70 years. And she actually leaves Siena, goes to France, to Avignon, and begs the Pope, Gregory, to return to Rome. And he finally listens, gets back there, and she was very direct, exercising her leadership at times. She would write letters to the popes and be very demanding. She didn't sugarcoat, if you will, her requests. It was, at one point, she told the Pope to be a man, in essence.
Wow.
Man up and come back to Rome. So that's it's exercising leadership is important, obviously, at the highest levels of the church and then among the clergy, but can also be exercised by a holy laywoman, a Dominican tertiary, as St. Catherine of Siena. And to the other side of that, when you have bad leadership, Again, at the highest level and even at the lowest level, it impacts the church greatly. You know, we've had in churches in the history of the church in the past, obviously examples of very, very bad popes. I mean, the Renaissance popes come easily to mind, with Alexander VI, Rodrigo Borgia, who lived an immoral life while he was pope, and who was just much more focused on temporal concerns than he was on spiritual matters, and caused significant problems and scandal for the church. But it's not just popes. It's even, you know, even just kind of regular faithful, if you will, the laity, who, if we don't live our faith authentically in the world, then we are not the light that we are called to be for the world, to bring them closer to bring people closer to Christ and to bring them into the church. So it's not just popes and bishops, right? It's the laity, too, that have a very important role to play, positively or negatively, in spreading the gospel.
Very well said, Steve. And obviously, you know, in the game of hockey, captains of teams wear the famous letter C on their jersey. Well, we need to sort of be known as, you know, leaders in a, you know, in another group fronted by a C, the Catholic Church. And so, yeah, we all have that C on our jerseys, if you will, as we go through this world, and we have to provide good leadership for those among us. It starts at the top, and it filters all the way down to the laity as well. Well, just before the break, we were talking about the Crusades, and we did have a question that came through on Twitter. Leilani asks, is there a good book for elementary-age kids on the Crusades? Now, of course, there was a famous children's crusade as well, a very ill-fated children's crusade, Steve. And that's not really what she means here, but maybe you could talk about that, too, when you answer that question.
Yeah, sure. I'll talk about the book first, I guess. I mean, I'm not really, again, you know, my forte is I teach adults, I teach graduate level courses, and so I'm not as focused or as aware of you know, children's literature or children's books and subjects. But I mean, my recommendation in that situation is really for adults. I think it's incumbent upon adults, teachers, educators, parents, to inform themselves, right, inform ourselves about church history and about the Crusades, to learn about them authentically, and therefore then we can teach, whether it's in a classroom setting or even in our own family, the authentic history of the Crusades. And I mean, I have seen some, you know, my own children using different textbooks from schools that talk about the Middle Ages or the Crusades, and they're usually not very accurate, frankly. And I take it as an opportunity to then obviously teach my children the authentic history of the Crusades, and they actually really know it before they leave the house, and then they read it and they go, okay, well, that's wrong. But, you know, that's important for us to be able to do that. And then to the Children's Crusade, that's kind of a weird thing, really, in the crusading movement, because, and it's somewhat of a misnomer. The Children's Crusade that occurred in the early 13th century was really not full of children, as the name implies, and it wasn't a crusade either. It wasn't an officially sanctioned movement. What it was really was a spiritual revival movement, if you will, full of youngish people, not necessarily children. We're talking more like adolescents and young adults that started in France. It moved into Germany, and it was this you know, spiritual movement of groups of people, not warriors, who wanted to have Jerusalem returned into Christian hands, and so it's part of the crusading movement. And you know, these different groups tried to make their way to the Holy Land. Some, a very small group, actually did make its way over there, but a lot of it petered out before they even got to the coast to be able to try to get to the Holy Land. And some of them actually made their way down to Rome to ask the Pope to forgive them to forgive their crusade vow. Many of them had actually taken the vow to go on crusade, and once you take that vow, you had to fulfill it or be dispensed from it, and many of them were dispensed from it. So it did peer up, but it was kind of reinforced in the Enlightenment. You had authors that had an animus against the Catholic Church that wanted to limit her influence in society, so they attacked her history, and they created this kind of myth of this horrible children's crusade. And, you know, just the imagery, right? We all think of toddlers running around with broadswords trying to kill people, and so it gives us pause.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for clearing up that.
But,
yeah, and thank you so much for clearing up that misconception about the Children's Crusade. It is very, very common indeed. We are with Steve Weidenkopf, church historian, live on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. And if you want to call in with your question for Steve on church history, call this number, 1-888-914-9149. Once again, 1-888-914-9149. 9149. Boy, it must be a lot of fun to teach your kids at school, you know, when she's sending home stuff on church history and the kids come back, oh, my dad says that's not true. And you know what? They're right. They're right, because you are an expert in church history. We're going to go to the phones right now. Paul is calling from Youngstown, Ohio. Paul, welcome to the program. You're on live with Steve Weidenkopf on the Cale Clark Show.
Hello. I was calling about something strange I had read once about a Pope Formosus and something called the Cadaver Synod. And I wondered if you could tell me what that was all about.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thank you, Paul, for your question. That's. I'm glad that you actually heard about that, because some people hear of it and some people haven't. And some people, frankly, are kind of shocked when they hear this story. But yeah, the story of Pope Formosus and the so-called Synod of the Corpse or Synod of the, you know, the Cadaver Council, or there's different kinds of names for this thing. But it's a real event. It did happen at the end of the 9th century. You had this Pope Formosus, who was, so to kind of set the stage here, at the end of the 9th century when this event takes place, we've had a problem in the papacy throughout the century where the popes are, and the those who are elected to the papacy, really, it's become, the papal elections, rather, have become a game in Italian power politics, in essence. Mm. You have a lot of very powerful, noble families in Rome and in the surrounding area of central Italy who want their own family members to be pope, and so it becomes a secular Game of Thrones, if you will, right? Who's going to be on the throne of in the chair of St. Peter? So Formosus is on the chair, and not only is it an issue of who becomes pope, but also there's a big issue in terms of who's going to be declared emperor. So back in the year 800, Pope Leo the Third crowned Charlemagne, the king of the Franks, the emperor. And so this was a title, when he did that made it this linkage between the papacy and the emperor. So the pope was the one who then nominated the emperor, or rather crowned the emperor. And so you had a lot of very powerful nobles who wanted this title, and they wanted to influence the papacy to grant them the title. And so this is the kind of political situation that we have. So what happens here is Formosus, at the end of the 9th century, he keeps switching support between different rival noblemen. So, you know, one nobleman, the Duke of Spoleto, comes to him and says, hey, I want to be emperor. And Formosus says, hey, okay, yeah, fine, I'll back you. But he doesn't actually crown him yet. Another nobleman comes in and says, hey, I want to be emperor. And he says, yeah, okay, I'll back you. So he keeps switching sides. He's giving support and withdrawing, and he's kind of playing this game of power politics. And he ends up upsetting basically everybody that he's in, dealing with. So what happens is Formosus dies in the year 896, and one of these noblemen whom he had spurned, a man by the name of Lambert II, he comes into Rome after Formosus had died, and he goes to the pope after Formosus, which is Stephen VI, and tells him, you know, look, I'm really angry at how Formosus treated me. I want you to dig up his corpse and put him on trial. And so Pope Stephen VII actually did that, or it's the sixth rather, actually did that. He actually had the corpse of the dead Pope Formosus, taken out of the grave, if you will, and placed in a chair in St. Peter's, and was actually put on trial for various crimes, trumped up charges and things like that. Obviously, Formosus could not give his own defense, so he couldn't speak in his own defense, so a deacon was appointed to be his lawyer, if you will, his counsel. But sadly, Formosus was declared guilty, or was proclaimed guilty of these various crimes. His body was actually desecrated. They ripped off three fingers from his hand that was used, the right hand that was used for blessing. They dragged the corpse through St. Peter's, and they threw it into the Tiber. So a macabre event in church history, but one that was true, but explainable if you understand the political background of what was happening at the time.
Man, maybe we should have saved this episode for Halloween. That was indeed a chilling, chilling tale from church history. We are with Steve Weidenkopf, church historian, lecturer in church history at Christendom College at the graduate school there. We're going to be right back with Steve after this short break. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. The Relevant Radio toll-free studio line is sponsored by Charity Mobile, the pro-life phone company. Information about their cell phones and monthly plans is available at charitymobile.com.
Hello, Canada and hockey fans in the United States and Newfoundland.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
We're back live on The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Our guest is church historian and hockey superfan, New York Islanders superfan, Steve Weidenkopf. He's joining us, and he has suffered through a lot of sketchy hockey history over the past few decades with the Islanders. Criminal mismanagement. They were actually owned by an actual criminal for a little while. They changed their logo to the horrendous and horrific Fisherman logo, the angry old Fisherman. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google that. You'll see, and your eyes will never forgive you for that. But anyways, times have changed, and the Isles are back on track. Maybe they can recapture their glory days. They won four Stanley Cups in a row in the early 80s, and maybe they can get back to the finals. We'll see what happens. Starting with Game 6 tonight. They've got to win this one tonight, right, Steve?
Yeah, they do. Let's hope the boys show up and kind of take it to the Lightning tonight and extend this here and give us more hockey so we can watch a Game 7 on Saturday. And, you know, thanks for bringing up the Fishermen. I was really hoping you kind of forget that. Most Islander fans try to forget that, at least in my generation. You know, that thing is actually, that logo is making a comeback among the younger generation. They Even my sons, you know, who I give them the history of the Islanders, and you know, I try to, you know, give them a Pavlovian response to when they see the fishermen to throw up. But you know, even they think, oh, that's kind of cool. You know, they should go back to, you know, it should be an alternate jersey. And you know, people of my generation and Islander fans were like, nah, don't even remotely talk about that thing.
But I can't see them selling a lot of those jerseys. But you never know. You never know. Those are the days of the franchise that you don't exactly want to recapture. They weren't exactly glory days, I'll tell you that. And hey, we've got you on a solid landline now, talking about things from ancient history. Landlines. I didn't even think to ask you if you had one. And we've got a good connection now. And we're talking about ancient church history on The Cale Clark Show with Steve Weidenkopf, who's written so many works, so many great books about the history of the church, such as The Real Story of Catholic History and Timeless, his latest book. You're working on a new one too, Steve, aren't you?
I am, yeah. It's coming out this end of this year in December by Ave Maria Press. It's called The Church and the Middle Ages. It's part of their six-volume series called Reclaiming Catholic Church History. There's multitude volumes. Mine is the one on the Middle Ages, so I'm really excited about that one.
And if people want to connect with you on your website, I know you do a lot of speaking, especially during the ancient history days of the pre-COVID times. Remember those? I know you travel a lot around North America to speak. And how can people get a hold of you if they want to get in touch?
Yeah, the best way is through my website. It's just Steve Weidenkopf, all one word, .com. You can connect with me there. I have all of, you know, my recent blog posts that I write that are up there, books and speaking engagements, and you can there's a contact form on there as well, so people can email me if they have questions or anything.
Okay, well, here's a question that a lot of people have, a lot of non-Catholics especially, and even Catholics too. There is a legend, an urban legend, a church legend, about a Pope Joan. And in fact, we have someone who wants to ask you about that. And her name is Joan, oddly enough. Joan, I don't know if you are Pope Joan, but you're calling from Wheaton, Illinois. Welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. You have a question about Pope Joan for Steve, right?
Yes. A few years ago, I read a book written about Pope Joan, and it said it was very well researched and it was historically accurate, and it gave this interesting story about a Pope Joan. And apparently when you look at the lineage of our popes, there might have been a Pope John and they skipped a number because they thought she might have been a Pope John and instead she was a Joan. So I'm curious if there was any validity to this or if this was just a fictional story that was set up to be history.
Thanks so much for your question, Joan. Appreciate that. What do you have to say, Steve?
Yeah, that's a frequent myth that's brought up about the papacy in particular, that there was this Pope Joan. And you know, the biggest thing to immediately talk about that with Pope Joan, and this is something that, again, another myth that I address in my book, The Real Story of Catholic History. But the thing that really is, I think, what kills this whole notion is that
the first recorded instance of there even being such a supposed thing as Pope Joan was in the 13th century. And that's the first recorded document or written evidence we have that even something like this may have occurred. And that's 400 years after supposedly there was a Pope Joan. I mean, I think just in and of itself, that I guess, you know, whatever you want, the documentary evidence that you want to, you call it, that right there kind of solidifies the deal, frankly. I think it's hard to imagine that for 400 years, if there had been a female pope in the church, or if as the legend goes, that there was someone who was elected to the papacy that everybody thought was a man, but then later on, after elected pope, people found out that the individual was actually a female, was a woman, then there's nobody mentions it until the 13th century. It was supposed to happen sometime in the 9th century, but it's never ever mentioned until the 13th century. So to me, it just doesn't make any sense. Something that odd, something that bizarre, something that kind of crazy, frankly, would have been mentioned somewhere in some setting, in some document, or would have been widely known, frankly, as a way to discredit the papacy by those who didn't like the papacy. But it wasn't. And eventually becomes very well known and becomes more of a myth that people utilize a lot once you get into the 14th and 15th century. And why that's important is because when you get to the 14th century in the 1300s was when we have a couple of different crises within the papacy. One is, as I mentioned earlier, when we were talking about leadership in the papacy, or leadership in the church, was when the popes lived in Avignon, so they lived in the south of France in the 14th century, and then they come back from France to Rome at the end of the 14th century in 1378, and it's there, too, soon after they come back from Rome, that we have what's called in history the Great Western Schism, where there are multiple men claiming to be pope. You know, at one point, there's three different men claiming to be pope. There's only one validly elected pope, but there are two anti-popes, if you will. And so the 14th century really was a very difficult, dark time for the papacy. And because of that, there's a loss of respect. There's a loss of recognition of the centrality and the unity of the papacy, and a lack of respect for the church in many ways, and the hierarchy in the church. So it's at that point where you begin to hear more frequently and see more frequently in various documentary evidences of this myth of Pope Joan. There's a famous Bohemian heretic, Jan Hus, who was condemned at the Council of Constance early in the 15th century. He mentions this myth of Pope Joan as a way to discredit the papacy. Once you start moving into the 16th century and the 1500s, and you have Luther and Calvin and the Protestant Revolution, you have more Protestant authors who begin to then bandy and beat the drum of this Pope Joan. And so there's you know, again, it's something that occurs much, much later in history from when it actually happened, and it's 100% absolutely false.
Steve Weidenkopf, thank you for joining us on the program, church historian, professor at Christendom College. Go to steveweidenkopf.com for more info on his great books and his speaking about church history. We'll have to have you on again, Steve, when we have more time. Thanks for joining us. Taking away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.
Day 10, Mothermost Chase, pray for us. It's not that the church is hung up on sex or the church is prudish. It's simply that the church promotes and defends human dignity and recognizes that the human race is the pinnacle of God's visible creation. Human beings have been created for eternity to give glory to God. That's why the church guards and elevates human sexuality and protects it in the sacred bond of matrimony. Children have a right to know their mother and father. Children have a right to be born and raised in a family. And the human race is a blessing to planet Earth. That's why the virtue of chastity is necessary. It safeguards sex and places it within the stability of marriage. Sex is always safe when used as God has intended it, between a man and a woman, open to life and within marriage. In that context, it is holy. Mother Most Chaste, pray for the church and our nation.
Receive these free daily messages by signing up at relevantradio.com/novena.